challenged. "Still determined to thwart me, are you?" She raised her left arm. "I've never met anyone so intent on dying." A long, thin object whirled through the air, striking the right of her chest and knocking her backward against the parapet. Rodario, much to his surprise, had succeeded in felling the eoil with his quarterstaff. "Ha!" he shouted, drawing a sword. "Some demigod you are! We know the truth about you, elf. You're powerless without the magic of the stone." Tungdil reached the flagpole and slashed the ropes with his axe. The crystal tube containing the diamond dropped into his hand. He threw away the cable and stuffed the tube behind the buckle of his belt. "You'll have to fight me for it." He limped toward her. "I haven't forgotten the innocent souls who died in your fires. Don't expect any mercy." A trickle of blood left her mouth and landed on her pure white robes. She drew the quarterstaff from her side and stepped away from the parapet. A crimson halo radiated from the right of her chest. Drawing her sword, she threw herself on the dwarf, who struggled to match her incredible speed. The sword and axe met in a ringing din. The eoil's delicate beauty belied her strength. Each blow was delivered with the force of a dwarven warrior, and Tungdil swayed, struggling to keep his balance because of his wounded leg. Rodario rushed to his aid, swiping at the eoil with his sword. "You're a nifty fighter, but you can't..." The eoil stepped nimbly aside, dodging the awkward attack. Without taking her eyes off Tungdil, she jabbed her sword with startling rapidity at the impresario, stabbing him in the belly. Rodario doubled up, screaming in agony as she rotated the blade before whipping it out. Tungdil swung his axe. The blade whizzed toward her, heading straight for her wounded chest. The eoil raised her sword to check the blow. The axe smashed down, shattering the delicate sword and continuing its trajectory. A split second later, the axe head embedded itself in the eoil's chest. The force of the blow knocked her sideways, and she stumbled into the parapet and overbalanced, pulling Tungdil, still holding the haft of his weapon, toward the edge. He unfurled his fingers, allowing the axe and the eoil to fall. Leaning over the parapet, he watched her descent. Twice she knocked against the sable walls of the tower, staining them crimson as she scraped against the stone. Her fall ended at the base of the tower, her dainty body smashing against the ground. Tungdil stared down at the sprawled eoil and released his pent-up breath. "The gods weren't with you." His hand patted the diamond hidden behind his belt. "I told you I needed more time to rehearse," Rodario groaned, and gripped his belly, trying to stem the blood. "Still, at least I didn't fall off the stage." Tungdil hobbled over and assessed his injuries at a glance. "The blade entered on the left, low enough to miss your organs," he reassured him. "I'll go down and..." He broke off as footsteps and jangling armor sounded from the tower. "It's not over yet." Placing himself in front of the injured Rodario, he drew his only weapon, a dagger, and turned to face the eoil's guards. A small figure in plate armor burst through the door, crow's beak on high. Realizing that the eoil had been defeated, he lowered his weapon and pushed back his visor to reveal a wrinkled face and a thick black beard. He stared at Tungdil and then the dagger.
"For pity's sake, scholar, what did I tell you? Never throw your only axe."
There wasn't time to swap stories. The two dwarves rushed down the stairs, past the crater made by the eoil, and into the vaults of the palace. Tungdil followed Boindil, who knew the way to the wellspring.
"I think it stopped my fall," he panted. "It took ages to hit the ground, and I remember praying to Vrakas to save me. Then suddenly I slowed down and floated like a feather."
He pointed down the stairs into the darkness.
"The source is down there. I reckon I fell on top of it. I was practically roasting by the time I reached the bottom."
"The armor must have saved you,"
said Tungdil. Gerdlegard owes a lot to Belindis. She'll be proud when she hears. The earth shook beneath them. This time the quake continued for a few seconds, covering the dwarves in a dusting of stone. The tower was showing signs of stress, and Tungdil spotted what looked like a crack in the wall. The shaking receded, but the ground was still moving.
"Is it far?"
he asked through gritted teeth. The pain in his thigh was almost unbearable, and he had to remind himself that Boindil, with his wounded chest, was faring worse.
"We're not there yet, scholar."
Boindil wished that the masters of Barista had installed a pulley system, like the moving platforms in Zamti's stronghold that carried the firstlings up and down in the blink of an eye.
"I suppose the wand-wielders use their hocus-pocus to fly up and down."
He offered his uninjured shoulder to his friend. At last they reached the bottom of the staircase and hurried to the center of the vaulted basement, where the carpet had been cut away to reveal an array of symbols engraved on the floor. Tungdil had been expecting to find a pool or a hole in the flagstones, but there was nothing. Magical springs were clearly different to the normal variety. Boindil examined the stone floor and held a hand above it tentatively. Nothing happened.
"It stopped working."
Tungdil produced the crystal tube containing the diamond.
"Let's hope we can get it started."
He placed the stone gently over the runes on the floor, and they waited with bated breath. The trembling continued. In fact, it seemed to intensify. Cracks were spreading through the base of the tower, and fragments of stone rained from the vaulted ceiling, crashing around them.
"The tower won't take much more," said Boindil,
running his hand along the wall.
"When it goes down, it will take the other towers and the conference chamber with it. Scholar, we need to get out."
Tungdil was staring at the runes, willing them to come alive and pulse with light. The diamond looked dull and lifeless.
"Maybe I need to smash the tube."
"Give me that," he said, reaching for the crow's beak. Taking aim, he brought the butt of the weapon against the glass, smashing it to pieces. The diamond survived unscathed, but nothing happened.
"What's wrong with the accursed thing?" bellowed Tungdil. "In the name of Vrakas, come alive!"
He whacked it again with the crow's beak.
"Come alive, why don't you?"
After the third blow, the dwarves gave up. Doubtless there was a way of releasing the magic energy, but neither of them knew how. The shaking was becoming more violent. Boindil grabbed his friend by the shoulder.
"We'll be buried alive in a moment," he growled. "Quick, let's go!"
Tungdil grabbed the diamond, and they hurried out of the vaults as fast as their heavy legs and ravaged bodies would allow. At the door to the tower, they found the corpse of the monster, surrounded by a ring of dead dwarves. And a little further, they discovered the remains of the Avatar's guards. But of the Alfar, there was no trace. The palace was deserted. Wheezing and panting, they hurried down the sweeping stairs into the courtyard, running to catch up with Radario, who was being carried to safety by a couple of dwarves. This time they made straight for the gates, knowing that the runes had lost their power. The bleached bones of intruders who had been stuck by magic to the walls now lay scattered on the ground. Barista had lost its magic. The next ferocious quake proved too much for the tower. Turning, they watched as the glorious palace of Leos Nudin was broken apart. The tower above the wellspring was shaking like corn in the wind, tilting wildly from side to side. Suddenly, the walls crumbled, and the uppermost third of the tower broke off. The deadly chunk of masonry crashed into the highest tower, smashing through its walls. The tower collapsed, raining chunks of marble over the palace and destroying the copper dome. One by one, the sable towers crashed to the ground. Clouds of dust rose from the debris, rolling toward them like a vast brown wave, and obscuring their view. Chips of marble flew through the air, and the sound of splitting stone echoed endlessly through the city.
Crouched behind the outer walls, they waited for the devastation to end. Dust clogged their eyes and nostrils, clinging to them like thick brown fog. Those who hadn't thought to cover their mouths and noses were already coughing and struggling to breathe. At last, the ground stopped shaking, and everything came to rest. Tungdil wiped the dust from his eyes and washed his face with a handful of snow.
Fracas protect us.
Nothing remained of the palace's former splendor. Tons of marble had flattened its lofty chambers, burying cycles of scholarship under its weight. It was as if the pillage wellspring had used the last of its energy to destroy the seat of Gerdlegard's mystic learning, which served no purpose now that the magic was gone. In any case, no one in Gerdlegard knew anything of the mystic arts. The last of the Magi was dead, and there was no one to take her place. Thoughtfully, Tungdil closed his fingers around the diamond.
What am I going to do with you?
He heard the tread of many feet and the familiar sound of jangling chainmail. Through the mist, the firstling queen and her warriors, accompanied by Gemmel and his dwarves, marched toward them. Tungdil spotted Belindis's smiling face at the front of the parade. Xamtes had survived the battle with only minor injuries, and her four-pronged mace glistened with enemy blood.
Thank Vrakus, you're all right. When the tower came down, we feared the worst. Who knows what the rest of Gerdlegard looks like, Tungdil said grimly. For all we know, Perista may have come off lightly compared to the other cities.
In spite of his bleak mood, he couldn't help smiling at Belindis. She came over and gave him a careful hug.
We routed the Avatar's army.
And we routed the Avatar's, rasped Rodario. You missed the performance of a lifetime. Tungdil and I defeated the Eoil. The blasted creature was an...
Apparition, said Tungdil quickly. The Eoil was made of mist, like the spirit that corrupted Nudeen.
He spoke loudly and deliberately, hoping that Rodario would take the hint. If the dwarves found out that an elf maiden was to blame for the destruction, the fragile truce between the dwarven kingdoms and Lutisil's folk would be endangered, and even the humans would start to take sides. In the eyes of some, the crimes of an individual justified the punishment of an entire kingdom or folk. Xamtes wasn't fooled.
How did you defeat the apparition without Keenfire?
A fatal error on the part of the Eoil, explained Rodario, playing along with the deceit. He assumed human form, which is to say, he made himself mortal. You should have seen the battle. He fought like a devil, but I stabbed him in the chest, and our twice victorious hero dealt the final blow.
Snow was still falling, pushing the clouds of dust to the ground. The air cleared, and the little group could breathe again. Xamtes shot Tungdil a knowing look, but allowed the story to stand, preferring not to challenge their victory in front of the jubilant troops.
How about we get these three to camp? She said, eyeing Tungdil, Rodario, and Boindil's wounds. My warriors will take care of the dead.
Tungdil started off, supported by Belindis, and promptly trod on something small and hard. Without really knowing why, he bent down and fumbled in the snow until his fingers closed around a finger-length shard of stone. He picked it up. It was green, slightly charred, and specked with frozen blood.
Namora's malachite.
He pocketed it quickly before anyone could see.
Just a bit of stone, he told Belindis. Nothing valuable, I'm afraid.
The news of the victory spread quickly through Perista. Relieved citizens pressed their faces to the windows to watch the dwarves march past. It wasn't long before they poured out of their houses to clap, cheer, and supply the warriors with food and hot drinks. In no time, Rodario and the dwarves found themselves at the center of an unexpected victory parade. Tungdil and his kinsfolk thanked the citizens for their kindness. It wasn't in their nature to celebrate in front of strangers,
but their tired, bearded faces revealed their contentment. Rodario was altogether less reserved, waving majestically from his stretcher and playing to the crowd.
"Fellow citizens, prepare yourself for the story of how I, the fabulous Rodario, and my trusty companion, Tungdil Goldhand, defeated the godlike Eoil. I look forward to seeing you in my theatre." He raised his voice. "Long live the dwarves, and long live Purista!"
The crowd roared approvingly and cheered the handsome hero. Boindil shook his head in disbelief.
"What?" said the impresario shamelessly. "I have to use these opportunities. I'll be reopening the Curiosum in a while."
Tungdil was busy thinking about what to tell Xamtes and the Dwarven Kings. He was inclined to stick to the story about the mist. If Rodario keeps quiet, no one need know that the Eoil was an elf. Sometimes it's better to hide the truth. He certainly didn't intend to confess that the accursed shard of malachite was in his possession. But the diamond was a different matter. He needed the others to help keep the magic in safe hands. With the city behind them, the full extent of the damage was revealed. The quakes had opened deep, dark trenches through the frozen fields, and in some places the ground had opened up and swallowed everything for hundreds of paces. Fortunately, the dwarven encampment had survived the tremors. A deep crack that passed through its middle, somehow having zigzagged round every single tent, preserving them all. "Xamtes and Gemmell's losses weren't too bad," said Belindis, helping Tungdil to lie down. She was doing her best to distract him while a physician examined his wounds. "The Alfar took the pressure off the firstlings and the freelings, but the thirdlings weren't so lucky. The northern front was a bloodbath. The Avatar's soldiers were massed behind the walls. The thirdlings are good warriors, but only a handful survived." The physician moved the dressing from Tungdil's leg and opened the wound to check for infection. "What of Salfalor?" growled Tungdil, gritting his teeth against the growing urge to scream. She shook her head. "He and Lorimbas died in the battle. Our warriors are looking for their remains." Tungdil's relief was mingled with disappointment. It was a fitting end for a dwarf killer, but it robbed him of the chance to avenge his murdered parents, and poor Mir. "Do you think the news has reached the Eternal Smithy? I'd like his victims to know that he's dead."
"I'm sure they do," she said, bending down to kiss him on the forehead.
For a moment they allowed themselves to feel at one, united by the love that would bind them together for the rest of their lives. Just then the fur drape at the entrance to the tent was pulled back, and Fergus charged in. He scanned the wounded dwarf, spotted Tungdil, and rushed to his side. His eyes were red from crying.
"Tungdil, thank goodness you're all right."
He clasped the dwarf's hand and shook it vigorously. "They said you might know where to find Namora. I've been looking for her everywhere. One moment she was fighting at the gates, and then she..." A tear trickled down his cheek and his lower lip quivered.
"Where is she, Tungdil?" he whispered thickly. "I've just buried my daughter. I can't bury my wife."
A chill came over Tungdil. Even little Dorsa wasn't spared. Inside he railed at the Eoil and the implacable stone of judgment. It was true that Namora's daughter was quarter elf, but no baby deserved such a fate.
"She died in a duel with the Eoil," said Tungdil.
He wanted Fergus to remember Namora as a heroine who had given her life in the fight against evil. "She tried to save Dorsa from the power of the diamond, but the Eoil was too strong. None of us could stop him draining the force fields." Fergus let out a despairing howl and buried his hands in his face. His loud sobs echoed through the dwarves' hearts, bringing tears to Tungdil's eyes. Fergus had paid more dearly than anyone for the Avatar's defeat. Belindis, moved by his grief, put her arm around his shoulders.
"What's the point?"
he asked in a muffled voice.
What was the point of all that suffering?
He raised his head and looked accusingly at Tungdil.
We went to war to save Gerdlegard, because you said there was a threat.
He jumped up and pointed to the door.
But what happened? Nothing. My wife died in vain. The Avatars wanted to free us from evil. And what did we do? We fought them.
He sat down slowly.
If we'd helped them, it would never have come to this. Namora and Dorsa would be alive.
Fergus, Tungdil said soothingly, you've lost the two people most precious to you. But the Stone of Judgment doesn't work like that. The Eoil wouldn't...
We could have shown them the way to Toborabor and led them to Borwal. We could have taken them to every single evil creature in Gerdlegard without endangering innocent lives. And they would have wiped the beasts out with their army. They only used their murderous magic because we attacked them. And it cost me my wife and child.
He got up and looked at Tungdil bitterly.
We attacked them because you told us to. We followed the dwarves' advice and we trusted you. Everyone in Gerdlegard trusted you. But this time you were wrong. Palandiel, save me from the charity of the dwarves.
He turned away, ignoring Tungdil's pleas. Pulling the tent flap back angrily, he disappeared outside.
Let him be, advised Belindis. It's no wonder he can't think straight when his heart is full of grief. Give him some time.
The physician cleared his throat to get their attention.
I'm afraid there's a shard of metal in your bone. I'll have to get it out.
He handed his patient a metal bar wrapped in leather. Tungdil smiled and tried to give it back, but the physician shook his head.
You'll need it. It's a painful business.
Tungdil put the bar between his teeth, and Belindis squeezed his hand while the physician's assistants exposed the bone by pulling back the flesh with metal hooks. A pair of tongs closed around the shard, and the physician began to pull. Tungdil didn't have time to clamp his jaws around the bar. His mind had shut down. Perista, former realm of Leos Nudin, Gerdlegard, winter 6235th, 6236th solar cycle. The citizens found a use for the fissures resulting from the quakes, and saved themselves the effort of breaking open the frozen earth to bury the enemy dead. The Avatar's soldiers were tossed unceremoniously into the trenches and packed down with rubble from the palace, of which nothing remained intact. Far away from the men, the fallen dwarves were laid to rest in individual graves. Firstlings were buried next to thirdlings and thirdlings next to freelings, a fitting end for the comrades in arms. Tungdil refused to believe that Vrakas would close his smithy to honorable dwarves of any provenance who upheld his commandments. For the first time in history, the folks were at peace. Boendil Hookhand, of the clan of the Swinging Axes, would return to the Blue Range as a hero, but not in the way that Boindil and Tungdil had hoped. Too severely burned for the healers to help him, the plucky secondling had died of his wounds. Boindil and Tungdil laid him on a shield and carried him, still dressed in his imposing armor as befitted a warrior, through the encampment and into Perista. The funeral procession came to a halt on the southern outskirts of the city. A group of firstlings had volunteered to help Boindil carry his twin to the secondling kingdom, where he would be laid to rest in his beloved Blue Range.
I couldn't bury him here, said a broken-hearted Boindil.
The loss of his twin was a blow from which he would never recover. Part of his soul had died.
He wanted to be buried at the High Pass. He'll always be keeping watch over Gerdlegard and protecting our kingdom from Teon's hordes.
Bowing his head, Tungdil looked sorrowfully at his dead friend and touched his cold, scorched fingers. He wasn't afraid to shed a tear.
Forgive me for missing your funeral, he apologized. I'll visit your grave when my work is done.
I hope to bring good news.
He turned to Boindil and embraced him as they mourned the loss of the brother and companion with whom they had shared so much.
Who's going to calm my fiery furnace now?
Sniffed his twin forlornly. Salty tears rolled down his cheeks, adding to the glistening pearl at the bottom of his beard.
I'll join you again soon, promised Tungdil in a choked voice. We'll drink a tankard or two to Boendal, and remember the old times. He's in the smithy, you know, with Sander, and all the others who died in the fight against the Avatars. Vrakas will have given him a proper hero's welcome.
They bade each other farewell. Then Boindil signalled to the firstlings to help him lift the shield. Tungdil made his way dolefully back to his tent, where an anxious Rodario was waiting for him.
He's gone, he sighed.
I know, said Tungdil. He left just now.
The impresario shook his head.
I mean Fergus, not Boindil. The best prop master in Girdlegard has vanished without trace.
He shrugged sadly.
I don't know what to do.
Tungdil poured himself and his guests some tea.
With the curiosum?
Who cares about the curiosum? Snorted Rodario. Admittedly, the special effects won't be the same without him. But Fergus was my friend.
He took a sip of his tea.
The poor fellow has been through such a lot. First he was attacked and poisoned. Then his son died before he woke up from the coma. And now, half a cycle later, he's had to bury his baby daughter. And as for Namora, there's nothing left but ash. Both dead in a single orbit.
He sighed again, this time more deeply.
Can a heart survive such sorrow? What if he tries to...
I'm sure he'll be fine, said Tungdil, doing his best to sound convincing. If he wanted to take his own life, he'd have done it in Perista, where his children and his wife met their end. I expect he's gone away for a while to clear his mind.
Rodario hoped fervently that the dwarf was right.
Fine. I'll go with your theory, hero of Perista. It's cheerier than mine.
Do you know what, Rodario? Confessed Tungdil. I'm tired of being a hero. Fergus was upset, and he said a few things that got me thinking.
He reported their exchange and took another sip of tea.
The thing is, he was probably right. Maybe I should have helped the Avatars, rather than oppose them.
He concluded sadly.
I beg to differ, said Rodario,
watching the steam rise from his tea.
It must have slipped my friend's mind that five towns were destroyed when the Avatars marched on John Balsur. 5 towns and 40,000 men, women and children. Think how many would have died if they'd marched on Toboribor and Borwal as well. Besides, the so-called Avatars wanted to carve up Girdlegard among themselves. Lurkim said they'd be mightier than kings, omnipotent and invincible. We wouldn't have lasted more than a couple of orbits with them at our helm.
He sipped his tea.
No, Tungdil. We did the only thing we could. We saved our homeland, and we rid the people in the outer lands of a band of tyrannical magi, not to mention an unhinged Eoil.
He nodded at Tungdil and smiled.
Fergus was right to be angry, but he was wrong to be angry with you. Girdlegard is indebted to Tungdil Goldhand and the dwarves. There isn't enough gold in these ranges to repay you.
Applause sounded from the door. The dwarven monarchs, Balendalin, Gandugar, Gemmel, Glaimbar, and Zamtis, were gathered at the entrance to the tent, accompanied by Prince Malin.
Well said, agreed the ruler of Eidoslane. Actors are prone to exaggeration, but it's impossible to speak too highly of the dwarves. The men and women of Girdlegard won't forget their obligation to the children of the smith.
To some of his children, Tungdil corrected him.
He studied the faces of the 4 dwarven kings and the firstling queen. His mood was somber.
The freelings and the thirdlings defended Girdlegard in our darkest hour,
And the Firstlings play their part as well. But the rest of you allowed yourselves to be fooled into leaving Girdlygard. A dwarven king should be strong enough and wise enough to stand his ground.
Gandagar bowed his head.
Tungdel is right. I shouldn't have ceded to the Thirdlings. I won't fail the dwarves again.
He left the doorway and walked to the center of the tent. Everyone took a seat. After all that had happened, the dwarven rulers had plenty to discuss, and Malin had indicated that he wanted to share some news as well.
Before we start, I'd like to ask Tungdil Goldhand to be my counselor, said Gandragar solemnly. We've all seen the folly of ignoring your advice.
Tungdil was flattered by the offer. The king of all dwarves wanted him, a thirdling, an exile, and a foundling, to be his personal counselor. But the Nodon-slaying, Eoil-killing hero had other things to accomplish before he could consider accepting such an offer. The High King agreed to let him think the matter over. It was Malin's turn to speak.
The tidings I bring will please some and grieve others, but mostly, I think, you'll be shocked.
He paused, looking gravely at the circle of expectant faces.
When King Bellatane requested permission for his troops to cross my land, I knew his help would be welcomed in Parista, and, not realizing his intentions, I agreed. As you know, his army never got here.
He took a deep breath.
Instead of heading west to Parista, Bellatane's army went east, toward the Black Range.
He produced a crumpled letter from his robe.
When I realized what had happened, I demanded an explanation. Bellatane wrote to tell me that King Lorimbas had failed to honor his treaty with Urgon, and he, Bellatane, had been deprived of the Fourthling's gold. By way of compensation, he ordered his soldiers to raid the Thirdling's stronghold and carry off their gold.
He handed the letter to Gandagar.
King Gandagar, there was an alliance between Bellatane and Lorimbas. An alliance against you.
Are the soldiers still there?
Asked Zamtis, while the High King stared at the letter in shocked disbelief. Malin shook his head.
I sent scouts to the Black Range. The gates were open when they got there, and the watchtowers were deserted. Inside, the corridors and halls were strewn with the corpses of dwarf women and children. Bellatane had ordered his soldiers to show no mercy to Lorimbas's folk.
Tungdil didn't want to believe what he was hearing.
There must have been some survivors,
he said hopelessly.
Dwarven kingdoms are full of passageways and secret vaults, said Zamtis with conviction. The Thirdlings are probably in hiding.
To the dwarf's dismay, Malin shook his head.
My scouts reported that most of the passageways have collapsed. The kingdom was all but destroyed in the quake. I'm not saying there weren't survivors, but their number will be small.
A whole folk, all but wiped out, murmured Tungdil.
He had always dreamed of a time when the dwarves could live together without fear or suspicion.
But not like this, Fracas.
He turned to Gandagar.
You asked me to be your counselor, Your Majesty.
My advice would be to send an army to guard the Black Range. Without Lorimbas and his warriors, the Eastern Pass is open to attack.
I'm sure the surviving Thirdlings will welcome your help, said Gemmell.
It could be the beginning of a new era, an era of peace for the dwarves. The most zealous dwarf killers are dead and buried in Parista. The others can't afford to continue the feud.
Bellatane's treachery won't go unpunished, said Malin. The rulers of Girdlygard shall hear of how he turned his back on the allies for the sake of some gold. The mad king of Urgon must be stopped before he takes it into his addled head to invade another dwarven kingdom.
The dwarves agreed wholeheartedly.
There's something I'd like to tell you, said Tungdil. I haven't mentioned it until now because the fewer who know the better.
He produced the small leather pouch containing the diamond and placed it on the table.
As kings and queens, you deserve to hear the truth.
He took out the stone. This is the last remaining source of magic in Girdlegard. The diamond is powerful enough to turn a magus into a deity. The Eoil was in the process of channeling its magic when Radario and I cut him down.
I was merely the sidekick, demurred Radario with a smile.
Everyone crowded around to examine the twinkling surface of the beautiful gem. Gandogar, king of the gem-cutting Forthlings, was an authority on diamonds.
It's magnificent, he said admiringly. The craftsmanship is dwarven in quality. Gem like this would be mentioned in our chronicles. The technique is different, too.
He picked it up carefully and held it in front of the candle. The flame, seemingly enamored by the flawless surface, leaned toward the diamond, which caught and amplified the light. The awed silence was broken by Tungdil. The Eoil spoke of undergroundlings. He probably got the diamond from dwarves in the outer lands. Gandogar set down the stone.
You say it would give a magus almost limitless power? Said Malin, frowning. With luck, none of our enemies will learn of its existence. But it needs to be under constant guard.
Exactly, said Tungdil. He turned to Gandogar. You've had a look at the stone, and I've made a few drawings. He got up, walked to his desk, and picked up a sheet of parchment. I've written down the exact measurements and sketched the cut. I propose we make copies and give them to the rulers of Girdlegard. The 7 human monarchs, the dwarven rulers, and Lutacil will each receive a diamond to guard. He looked at them earnestly. Build vaults, set traps, employ sentries. Do whatever is necessary to ensure the stone is safe. Tungdil's plan met with approval.
How will we know which of us is guarding the original? Asked Zamtis.
We won't, that's the idea. I'll keep the diamond until Gandagar has made the replicas. Then we'll put them in a pouch, add the original, and shake them together. After that, we'll trust to Vrakus and draw the stones at random. You might draw a replica, you might draw the original. But neither you nor I nor anyone who chances to learn of the stone's existence will be able to tell.
He turned away from Zamtis to address the other monarchs. This is Girdlegard's biggest secret. Only the members of this council, Lord Lutacil, and the other human rulers must know of the stone.
Belendalin stroked his beard.
Without the diamond, we'll never have another Magus or Maga. The only magic in Girdlegard is hidden in the stone. How long do you propose we hide it?
I don't know, but maybe in time we'll entrust the diamond to a human, an elf, or a dwarf, and start a new line of Magi. The right individual will know how to identify the stone. He returned the diamond to its pouch and stowed it behind his belt. If you ask me, we'll be better off without any magic for a while. No one was inclined to disagree. Next, they made arrangements for sending an allied army to the ruined Thirdling Kingdom with the dual purpose of rescuing survivors and sealing the Eastern Pass. In future, the dwarves would have to travel between the ranges on foot because the underground network had been destroyed by the quakes. The meeting ended late that night. Prince Malin was the first to leave, followed by Queen Zamtis and the Dwarven Kings. King Glaimbar stayed behind to talk to Tungdil. The Fifthling monarch held out his hand.
How can I ever repay you, Tungdil Goldhand? First you saved my life in the Grey Range. Then you rescued Balindis from the Avatars.
Tungdil shook hands with him gladly. He couldn't bring himself to hate Glaimbar for stealing Balindis. It seemed wrong to harbor grudges when fortune had treated others more harshly.
I came to the aid of a dear friend. You would have done the same. If I were to ask you what you wish for more than anything, what would you say?
Asked Glaimbar, levelly, looking him in the eye.
I would ask you to give up Balindis so she could follow her heart, he answered honestly. But since it's not in your power, I won't.
He gripped the king's hand.
My greatest wish is that you look after her, honor her, and make her happy.
You're a better dwarf than me, Tungdil Goldhand, said Glaimbar, shaking his head in wonder. He turned to leave, then stopped and looked back at Tungdil.
They should have made you king,
he said sincerely. The tent flap closed behind him. Tungdil gazed after him deep in thought.
Perhaps, he murmured, smiling. But I was the one who turned down the crown.
He poured himself another mug of tea. He knew it was time for bed. Before he could take the diamond to Gandagar in the Forthling Kingdom, he had to travel north to Alandor and east to Jon Valsur. A good deal of snow, sludge and mud would pass beneath his boots before the coming of spring. He smiled, remembering how Rodario had looked at him in horror when he announced his intention to travel alone to the Alfar's kingdom.
What in the name of Palandiel do you want in that confounded place? Don't tell me you want to look for survivors. You saw for yourself that the Stone of Judgment worked.
Tungdil had told him that he wasn't interested in the Alfar. He was after his axe. He carried his tea to his mattress, removed his fur cloak, and slipped beneath the covers. Before he fell asleep, he got up again to throw a few logs on the camp stove to banish the winter chill.
It's my duty to see this through, he thought sleepily, closing his eyes.
Chapter 10 Elven Kingdom of Alandur, Girdlegard, Winter Spring 6236 Solar Cycle. Tungdil peered up at the lofty branches laden with snow. All winter the boughs had bowed and sagged beneath the extra weight, proudly refusing to break. With the worst of the winter over, the sun was strengthening, freeing the trees from the snow. Springtime beckoned, and soon Girdlegard would be awash with colour. His old friend Frala used to love the first orbits of spring.
So many of my friends are dead, he thought gloomily, as he made his way between the mighty trunks.
On his previous visit to Alandor, he and his company had been given a cool reception by the elves. This time his presence seemed to go unnoticed. He hadn't seen a soul since he first set foot in the Elven Kingdom 2 orbits ago, following the narrow path deeper and deeper among the trees. He wondered when he was going to be met by Lutisil, the elven lord with claret-coloured hair. The answer came sooner than expected. On rounding a corner, he came to the end of the path and entered a clearing. In front of him was a vast green tent that seemed to be made of satin. An elven archer was posted at each of the corners, and Lutisil, dressed in ceremonial robes, hailed him from the door. Smiling warmly, he shook the dwarf's hand.
Congratulations, Tungdil Goldhand. Everyone in Girdlegard must have heard of your victory.
He gestured for Tungdil to enter the tent.
Come in. We thought you might like somewhere to rest your weary legs.
Tungdil bowed to the elven lord.
Thank you.
Stepping inside, he was struck by the splendour of the tent. Dwarves and humans built their tents with canvas and plain wooden poles. But Lutisil's shelter was made of satin and elegant pillars of aromatic wood, each carved with intricate hunting scenes and embellished with runes. Tungdil wondered how he could bear to dismantle such a beautifully crafted tent. It was pleasantly warm inside, thanks to a pair of stoves and decorative lanterns hung from the ceiling, casting a pleasant glow. To Tungdil's surprise, the air smelled neither of soot nor burning tallow. 2 chairs and a table had been placed at the center of the tent, and steam was rising from an array of hot dishes.
You must be hungry from your journey, said the elf,
signaling for Tungdil to be seated.
I suppose you're here to scold me for not sending my archers to Perista.
Tungdil took off his heavy winter coat to reveal the suit of armor that had saved him from the Avatar's firebolts. He took a sip of warm beer, After orbits of cold victuals and water, it was good to thaw his insides. He was ready to bet that the elves had prepared the brew with him in mind. It was spiced with pine needles and tasted stronger and maltier than the smooth ales favoured by Lutacil's kind.
No one blames you for not sending your archers. It was curiosity that brought me here.
He paused.
If you joined the Allied army, you would have fought alongside the Alfar, and no one could demand that of the elves. At least, that's what the humans are saying. The dwarves put it down to the trouble in Jon Belsur. They didn't resent your absence. No child of the smith would willingly act as a buffer between the Alfar and the elves.
He piled his plate with victuals, none of which looked familiar.
All things considered, the Allied army was better off without you.
He popped a morsel into his mouth, hoping it would taste like meat, which, thankfully, it did. The elf could tell that Tungdil had a different theory about his motives for staying away.
Well, he prompted, why do you suppose we didn't come?
I don't suppose, said Tungdil, looking him in the eye. I know. You see, the reason you didn't help us was because of the E-oil.
It's all right, he reassured him. Rodario and I won't tell anyone that the Avatar conjurers were taking orders from an elf. We don't want any more feuds.
He paused to measure the effect of his words. The guilty expression on Lutacil's face indicated that his suspicions were correct.
Lord Lutacil, you owe me the truth. Who was the E-oil?
Lutacil's fork hovered by his mouth. Then he set down his cutlery and left the meat on his plate.
I admit it, Tungdil. You're right. My archers would sooner die than take up their bows against an E-oil. Her most fervent supporters wanted to ride to Perista to join her army, but thanks Italia, I convinced them not to go. The E-oil and her confederates were wrong to take the lives of innocent humans.
She was an elf then. Did she come from Alandor?
Lutacil pushed away his plate and poured himself a goblet of mulled wine.
E-oils don't have kingdoms or homes. They're mythical beings, part of our legends.
He took a long draught of wine and began his tale.
Citalia, daughter of Palandiel, created my people from light, pure earth, and dew. She taught my ancestors the art of healing and told them the secrets of nature and life. Her first commandment was respect for life in all its forms, and she frowned on destruction. Music, dance, poetry, painting, sculpture, those were our pastimes, and we knew nothing of hardship or war. My forefathers' endeavors met with incomprehension and hostility from the humans and dwarves. Citalia, realizing that her children were unhappy, gave them a new home where they could live in seclusion among the trees. The eldest of our kind were touched a second time by the hand of their creator, and they became our teachers, the higher elves. Meanwhile, the Dark Lord Teon grew weary of the gods' creations. His fellow divinities had applied themselves to the creation of good, so he rebelled by spreading evil. He buried his creation in the earth like a seed, knowing that it would grow and multiply with weed-like speed. Orcs, ogres, trolls, kobolds, bognilim, giants, and other dark creatures were born. Cycles later, the evil was brought to the surface by salt miners, gold diggers, and dwarves. Teon gave wings to the evil and cast it into the air to be carried on the wind. Worse was to come. The Lord of Darkness mixed his evil into lakes and rivers, and those who drank thereof were robbed of their innocence. Envy, greed, hatred, and lust entered the hearts of the elves, dwarves, and men. Next, Teon pierced the flesh of the other god's children with a thorn that he called Age, and the races of Girdlegard became mortal. His dark work was noticed by Citalia, who removed the thorns from the higher elves before the damage was done. And so the E-oils were created.
Lutacil emptied his glass.
So you see why no child of Sitalia could take up arms against an Eoil. They're as old as time, created by Sitalia herself. Eoils are the source of our knowledge, Sitalia's warriors, fighting Teon in all his forms. They're sacred beings, worshipped and revered. He paused. Sitalia would kill us if we dared to challenge an Eoil.
Tungtil nodded, although the explanation seemed decidedly flawed. He took another mouthful.
Did this particular Eoil deserve to be worshipped? She wasn't very complimentary about the elves. According to her, you're lesser beings.
The elf smiled good-naturedly.
The Eoils think we're inferior because we're tarnished by age. They live as long as they like.
Or as long as we let them, said Tungdil, picturing the Eoil's body at the bottom of the tower.
Are the other Eoils like the one in Perista? It's odd they're not mentioned in our chronicles.
The Eoils are no business of the men and the dwarves. We rarely speak of our history to outsiders.
He refilled his goblet. Most Eoils are peaceful beings. I'm personally acquainted with two of their kind, pure souls who devote their time to teaching the arts. Painting and singing are their passions, not destruction.
Tungdil was surprised and encouraged by Lutisil's willingness to answer his questions.
The Eoil in Perista was more powerful than any Magus, he began. She drained the energy from Perista, but I was wondering, can elves work magic too? There's no knowing what danger could be heading our way, and perhaps the next Magus will be an...
Lutisil shook his head.
No, Tungdil, you won't find a Magus in Alandur. Sitalia doesn't grant us the gift of magic anymore.
There's no chance of an elf being born with magical talents.
I've waited cycles for such an occurrence, he confessed. 400 cycles, to be precise. Every baby in Alandur is tested for magical ability, but to no avail. Thankfully, the Alfar have been destroyed, so we don't need a Magus to protect us anymore. He smiled. No wonder they call you scholar. At this rate, there won't be anything you don't know.
I wouldn't want to know everything. It would make life very dull. The dwarf sipped his beer and plucked up the courage to try a strange-looking fruit. It tasted of berries and mint.
I wanted to ask you about the Alpha, actually. Who are the immortal siblings? I saw them in Perista. I'm not sure what happened to them after they attacked the Eoil.
He leaned over the table.
Do they live forever like Eoils? Are they free from the thorn of age as well?
Tungdil could tell that Lutisil wasn't prepared to answer. Elves and Alfar had more in common than the proud archers of Alandur liked to admit. He thought about Namora, remembering how she had worked magic even before her transformation through the Malachite. The Alfar can extinguish flames with their thoughts. They move soundlessly. They don't leave footprints, and they meld with the dark. An unpleasant thought occurred to him.
Can the immortal siblings work magic? Real magic?
What do you mean?
Lutisil seemed puzzled. Could the immortal siblings have used magic to leave the tower and hide from the Stone of Judgment?
Lutisil sat up straight and looked him in the eye.
The immortal siblings are as much of a mystery to the elves as to the dwarves or the men.
I'm afraid I can't help you.
He thought for a moment. In my opinion, they might be able to work real magic, but I doubt they could escape the power of the stone.
He raised his goblet.
I'd like to propose a toast. To the destruction of the Alfar.
He clunked his glass against the dwarf's tankard. Tungdil decided not to probe any further. Lutisil's sudden evasiveness warned him that further questions would be unwelcome.
I won't breathe a word of what you've told me, he assured him. But there's one last thing I need to ask. What will you do if Gerdligard is attacked by another Eoil?
The elven lord pressed his fingertips together.
Nothing, Tungdil Goldhand. To do anything would be folly.
He picked up his cutlery and resumed his meal.
They ate in silence,
savouring the elven feast. Then Tungdil gave his account of the battle, the death of enemies and friends, the destruction of the Thirdlings, and the power of the diamond. He made no mention of his intention to travel to Jon Balsur, merely saying that he was planning to join Gandogar in the Brown Range. At last it was time for Lutisil to leave the tent, so that Tungdil could get some sleep. Before he went, he promised the dwarf that he would take good care of his diamond when it arrived. He handed Tungdil a little backpack. "It's a tent," he explained. "You won't have to worry about wind, rain, sun, snow, or frost. From now on you'll sleep so soundly that you'll think you're in a dwarven hall. I'll pray to Sitalia to pardon you for the death of the Eoil." They shook hands, and Tungdil was left alone in the tent. He finished his beer. "I killed an immortal elf." He let out a little burp and grinned. "I guess that makes her mortal." Former Kingdom of Jon Balsur, Girdlegard, Spring, 6236th Solar Cycle. Tungdil came to the end of the path that the Allies had burned through the forests of Jon Balsur and crossed the plains to the fortress of Arvir. From there he continued to the lip of an enormous crater left by the fist of an angry god, or so it seemed to Tungdil. Looking down, he surveyed the deserted city of Jon, one-time capital of the Alfar. No dwarf had ventured this far into the Alvish kingdom. In fact, only the Alfar and their prisoners had ever seen the fabled city, and no one would have thought it possible that an outsider could get there without drawing his axe. The only impediment to Tungdil's progress was his leg, which hadn't recovered from his duel with Ondori. Since crossing the border, he had disappeared up to his boots in mud and battled his way through waist-high grass, but he hadn't encountered another living soul. There was no sign of the Alfar. Every step of the way, he had steeled himself for finding survivors or receiving a black-fletched arrow in his back. But it was deathly still in the Alvish kingdom. It seemed the Stone of Judgment had done its work. There was something grimly fascinating about the architecture below. It had nothing in common with elven art, and its sinister darkness was palpable from his vantage point 2 miles above the city. The most formidable structure, a white tower made of bones, rose from a solitary pinnacle at the center of the crater. From a distance, the pale needle seemed to pierce the clouds, and Tungdil knew at once where he would find his axe.
"Fracas be with me."
He began his descent into the darkness of the city below. As soon as he left the rim of the crater, the light dimmed, and he felt an unpleasant chill. The strange city had an indefinable aura of horror, and he tightened his grip on his axe. Every sense was keyed, and his ears detected the slightest noise. Loose shutters rattling, squeaking metal, groaning wood, and the whistling of the wind around sinister roofs. He reached the bottom of the crater and continued along streets of pale white gravel that crunched beneath his boots. Every step seemed deafening, and it took all his courage to keep going. From time to time, grey smoke rose from the roofs, and ash rained down on him as if the dead Alfar were determined to hinder his advance. His nervousness surprised him. He checked his surroundings, looking left and right, peering down alleyways and bracing himself for attack. "I've fought orcs, slain beasts, and killed an immortal elf. So why am I scared of a deserted city?" He walked and walked, realizing that the Alvish city was much bigger than it had seemed. It was evening by the time he reached the base of the pinnacle and started up the steps. At last, panting with exertion, he got to the top just as the sun disappeared below the rim of the crater, plunging the city into darkness. Towering into the sky, the Palace of Bones shone blood red in the setting sun, while down below the roofs of the houses glimmered with symbols and runes. The hairs on his arms and on his neck stood on end. What if the ghosts of the Alfar haunt the city at night? He waited.